Oh, hello. Oh, it's you. Oh, well, now that you're here, yes. I hope you enjoy the show. Ta-ta.
Hello and welcome to this, the third edition of Bad News, a collaborative and international news show documenting struggles relating to anarchism, anti-authoritarianism and anti-capitalism from around the world. On this episode, we have an edit from the Final Straw Radio from the area known as North Carolina about grand juries and the United States judicial system. Our comrades at 98FM in Athens provide us an update on the latest cases of state repression in Greece. Also, our friends at A Radio Berlin inform us about the latest news from the struggle of the Mapuche people situated in Argentina. And last but not least, we'll play a few moments from our latest episode here in London at Dissident Island, including the issue of abortion on the island of Ireland, as well as an update about anti-fracking campaign in Lancashire in the north of England. But first, it's over to Radio Kuruf with an update from Concepcion in Chile. This episode features the issue of government social care projects.
Hello, angry comrades. We are from Radio Kuruf, and these are the bad news from Chile.
Es otra noche más de caminar.
Es otro fin de mes. From the crib to the jail, the tragedy inside the tsunami. The Chilean childhood is suffering a sad bereavement. Everybody is paying attention to the SENAME, the National Child Service, a government agency that should take care of the life and integrity of children and teenagers that break the rules, or come from families with problems, or has parents who cannot take care of them, or many other reasons with the same beginning, the hard social inequality in Chile. The purpose of this institution is the social reintegration and the rehabilitation, but in fact the opposite happens. The brutal truth was known recently because of the report made by the investigative committee of this service and because of the research carried out by the National Institute of Human Rights. In these documents, the people could find out that 1,313 children and teenagers died between 2005 and 2016 in Sename centers because of the bad conditions, unhealthy, torture, and abandonment. The investigation started with the death of Lisette Villa, a 12-year-old girl who died last year in a Sename house in Santiago. In this moment, the national director of the institution, Marcela Labraña, said that the girl died because of sorrow, but the family and the investigation declared that the girl was found with signs of an uncured flu, beats, hurts, and physical and psychological neglect. The horror that the children and teenagers live inside the Sename centers is a consequence of a neoliberal system designed to finance private institutions with public funds to administrate the centers. That's the way how a corruption network appears, because the money is not used at all for the care of the boys and girls, nor for make better the conditions for the workers of the centers. And all of this happens without any inspection from the state, letting the mafias work inside, producing terrible deaths, tortures, rapes, and sexual exploitation, and the victims are the children and teenagers under the care of the state. What happened is a disaster. Sename houses are not homes. These have become into real jails for the boys and girls. As a consequence of this, more than the half of the 41,000 people that are in prison in Chile have been in Sename centers. The goal of the system is not reached. The government and the opposition fight for the power and control, while thousands of children and teenagers live and die in the same conditions like Lisette every year, every day.
Now it's over to 98FM Athens.
The Bad News Report from Athens, August 2017. The civil justice has shown her ugly face again. Two young people with libertarian ideals were forced to prison with unfounded data. 6 years before, Iriana's boyfriend, who was also Pericles' roommate, was accused of being member of the revolutionary group Cells of Fire. He was then proclaimed innocent and released irrevocably. Nevertheless, Iriana and Pericles were accused of being members of the same group due to some very questionable forensic findings. In Iriana's case, the DNA specimen on a gun that was linked to an equally questionable statement of a witness. More than 270 bioscientists signed a protest letter that underlined the lack of scientificity of the police's laboratory procedure. In the case of Pericles, the finding was a part of his fingerprint on a book that was found in a suspect's house in Volos. Despite the obvious framing of the comrades, on the 17th of July, Iriana's and Pericles' appeal was denied and they were convicted to 13 years of prison. The state's goal is without doubt to criminalize social relationships with politically active people and individualize the social struggles to a larger extent. The mass media's terrorism is backed from our so-called left government in order to wipe out every hint of dissidence expressed. The role of the righteous and powerful government must be fulfilled by any cost. These bad news also have an optimistic side. The outrageousness of the civil justice has spurred an unusual amount of political vivacity and, on top of that, originating from many various political environments. Artists, delegates, political and social organizations, even international ones, expressed their anger and disbelief about the accusations and the results.
Another case of political imprisonment underlies the viciousness of the Greek civil justice. Tasos Theofilou was found guilty of participation in manslaughter during a bank robbery in Paros Island in 2012, linked with the action of the revolutionary group Cells of Fire. He was condemned to 25 years of prison without any evidence. No witness was able to recognize him. It was only an anonymous phone call to the anti-terrorist unit that linked him with this incident. A hat with his DNA was then added to the case as evidence, but it was later proven that this hat was not the hat worn by the robber. Theofilou fully assumed his anarchist ideals and his political involvement, which was clearly the only real link with the incident. The mass media presenting him as a ruthless terrorist and killer figure, certainly inspired by his graphic comics. One of his memorable quotes is that he is guilty, indeed, but of choosing the side of the oppressed in the class war through his political action as an anarchist. His imprisonment had already started when he was condemned in November 2013, and it was only on the 7th of July 2017 that his case was re-examined and he was found innocent of his accusations. Therefore, he was released after spending 5 years of his life in prison for being an anarchist. This time, the mass media were not there to criticize the ill functioning of the civil justice that can put a person in prison without any evidence and without being able to give these years back.
On the 17th of July, protests and riots erupted at the refugee camp on Lesbos Island, a camp which hosts more than 2,000 refugees that cross the border between Turkey and Greece. The protests started due to the delay of the authorities to provide legal papers. The police invaded the camp, beat up and arrested refugees based on their skin color. 31 of them got imprisoned in several prisons around the country, another 2 will be set for deportation, and 2 have been released. Many of them sued the police for using excessive violence.
2 refugees, Bahruz Arash and Kozin Hussein, imprisoned in the deportation center of Lesbos Island, went on a hunger strike for more than a month, demanding their release. The 2 refugees have been detained without having had a trial for many months. After a month of hunger strike, having lost 30% of their body weight, they stopped the hunger strike. A solidarity demonstration took place on the 5th of August outside the deportation center. Another refugee, Amir Hampey, was released after 25 days of hunger strike.
A new decision by the Supreme Court of Greece concluded against the right of workers to do retention of work when they are not paid by their boss. The Supreme Court said that the retention of work by the workers can be considered an abusive action when the boss had financial difficulties.
The workers of Egnatia Highway have gone on strike on the 27th of July and the 8th of August in solidarity with the local community, reacting against the construction of 40 new toll stations along the highway, which are expected to raise the cost of traveling in northern Greece.
A nationwide strike of the workers in tourism took place on the 20th of July. Cooks, hotel employees, waiters and other workers demanded collective agreements with the company owners and better working conditions and salaries.
Termita Squad in Volos is threatened with eviction. The owner of the building, the University of Volos, has started the process for finding a technical company to demolish the building. Militant groups attacked several technical companies who had applied for the demolition project, whereas one company decided to drop their participation after the social outcry. That was the bad news from Athens.
August 2017.
Next, it's over to the Final Straw Radio. This is the Final Straw Radio from the so-called USA, and you're listening to Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World. This month, we'd like to share something from home. We present a conversation with a legal activist doing support work around political repression of radicals, in general about the process called federal grand juries, and in particular around the resistance to the FGJ by Katie Yao, an anarchist from North Carolina. More on our project can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and more about Katie's case and grand juries can be found at ncresiststhegrandjury.com. For members of the listening audience who don't know, can you briefly explain what grand juries are?
So what a grand jury is a formal court process that is intended to produce indictments or formal charges for people. And they exist both on the federal court level or national level, and then also on a regional or state court level. So what happens in the grand jury process is that the U.S. attorney on the federal level presents information, whether that be information from law enforcement or witnesses or physical information, evidence, to jurors who sit on this grand jury. And those jurors determine whether there is enough evidence to formally proceed with an indictment or charge for crimes.
So how does that differ from the normal appearances that people make before court once a charge has been leveled?
So a grand jury is essentially what happens before somebody goes to trial. So the sorts of things that are available to you legally as protection once you've been charged and indicted with a crime are not available to you if you are called in as a witness and have been subpoenaed and legally required to appear before the grand jury. So the kinds of things that people understand are available to someone during the course of a fair criminal trial are not available to you during a grand jury proceeding, like having your attorney present in the room with you or a judge who's present in the courtroom. The only people who are present during a grand jury proceeding are the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, the 16 to 23 jurors that sit on the grand jury, whatever witness has been brought into the room, and then a court reporter who's doing all of the note-taking of the process.
What is the proven effect on social movements of this approach by the government of employing grand juries?
The way that social movements and political movements have been targeted by grand juries is subpoenaing people to the grand jury and then holding that person, you know, when they refuse to comply, continue to act in solidarity with the movement that they come out of and that they're a part of, incarcerating that person, putting them into jail or prison. That alone takes a toll on the movement, but also, again, because they operate in total secrecy, you can't know who has complied, who has cooperated. And so it can also start to spread suspicion, paranoia, and fear throughout that community that's being targeted.
In past years, the anarchist movement has been involved in a few of these contraptions. Would you talk about those instances and the ongoing one currently in the southeastern so-called United States?
So grand juries have been used, you know, for many years to target people in social and political resistance across the so-called U.S., but we've seen kind of an uptick in that. And starting in 2010, 2012, there were some pretty significant grand juries that were convened with significant resistance in response to them. One being anti-war activists and organizers in the Midwest from the Chicago area. 23 people were subpoenaed, refused to comply, and continue to act in solidarity with the people that they were, you know, in resistance with. And then also in 2012, in the Pacific Northwest region of the so-called U.S., there was a grand jury convened targeting anarchists specifically in both Oregon and Washington state, and a number of people were subpoenaed, a number of people refused to cooperate and were incarcerated for that. And then a couple of years ago, there was a person named Jerry in New York City who was subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury, refused to cooperate, and Jerry's an anarchist. So there is this, you know, recent history of anarchists specifically being targeted with grand juries. And what's happening now in the southeast region of the so-called U.S., in the state of North Carolina, is that a grand jury has been convened. What the state says, or what the government says, is to investigate an alleged firebombing of the Republican Party headquarters for that county that it occurred in. A person named Katie Yao has been subpoenaed. Katie is a longstanding member of community in North Carolina, is a anarchist, and has also refused to cooperate with this investigation. Should also be noted that when the government did finally respond to a request to reveal what they were investigating and trying to criminally charge people for, which they actually don't have to tell you, they said that not only were they investigating this alleged firebombing of a Republican office headquarters, but also, quote, other things. And so it seems as if the net that's been cast is extremely wide in this situation, as it has been in the past in other situations.
Can you talk a little bit more about what resisting a grand jury looks like?
So when somebody chooses to be in resistance to essentially this witch hunt, right, that is targeting whatever movement or, you know, community that they're a part of, they're running a pretty high risk. Even though they've never been criminally charged with something, they can still be incarcerated. And so resistance to that looks like often people immediately start mobilizing community support for the person or persons who have been subpoenaed and are making their resistance public, which is a really clear strategy that has been utilized numerous times throughout history of social resistance in the so-called U.S., making that really public and building solidarity, not just in the immediate community that people are a part of, but also trying to broaden that out nationally and even internationally. A lot of time, resistance looks like people holding rallies outside of federal courthouses, people doing banner drops, people doing the kinds of things that anarchists like to do when they're in resistance for many different things, but also trying to build up really strong support for the people who are actively resisting the grand jury, the people who have been subpoenaed. And what that looks like is making sure that their needs are met so that they feel supported through this process, because they're taking quite a hit to continue to be in solidarity with the community that they're a part of and with the movements that they're a part of. And so helping people with things that seem really simple and basic, like self-care, you know, in the lead up to that process, also helping to organize legal funds and raise that money, also trying to ensure that all of their needs, if they are incarcerated, that their rent is paid at their home and they have a home to come home to, that their children in their life or, you know, elders in their life that they are responsible for caring for, that those needs are met as well if they were to be incarcerated. Not only is that resistance and that kind of community support that people mount for this person important on a political level, on, you know, a community level, but it's also a part of a legal strategy that can be used to help get that person out of prison if that's what happens.
Do you have any opinions about the purpose of the grand jury in terms of the ruling party's administration and its reaction to shows of resistance since the inauguration?
I think that we are in a political climate right now here in the so-called U.S. where not only the Trump administration, but local governments, local police departments are really coming down hard on resistance in all of its various forms. And I think that what the state alleges happened down in North Carolina at Republican headquarters, this happened back in October, before the election ever happened. This grand jury, as far as we know and understand, based off of the limited information that the government has made public, that was convened many months ago. But they are specifically targeting anarchists with this grand jury. And that's very clear. They've chosen to subpoena someone that I'm sure they were aware was never going to cooperate. And so this is seemingly, in my opinion, less about trying to figure out any details about an alleged firebombing and more use it as a way to try and essentially smite resistance.
So there is a legal strategy outside of like solidarity within movement to resisting a grand jury. Can you talk about what part prior resistors, including Jerry Coach, play in that precedent setting?
There is a legal argument that can be made once someone has been incarcerated for the refusal to cooperate with the grand jury. That legal argument is called a Grumbles motion. The grand jury resistor's attorney or, you know, team of attorneys argue to a federal judge in this situation that this incarceration that they are using as a coercive tactic to try and extract testimony from that person has gone from being a legal coercive incarceration to being an illegal punitive incarceration because the person has committed no crime and they've made it quite clear that they are never going to cooperate and they've maintained that stance of non-cooperation. Using a coercive incarceration to extract the testimony out of them has moved from coercive and legal to punitive and illegal. They're essentially punishing that person for their refusal to cooperate. With Jerry, there was an excellent Grumbles motion written by his attorney that has changed the way that a federal judge would be legally burdened to respond to a Grumbles motion and have to uphold that Grumbles motion in court. And so all of that stuff can be very legally complicated. But in summation, all of that community support that people get, prior grand jury resistors, you know, providing support to current grand jury resistors and circling around those people, and people doing things like banner drops and solidarity rallies, all of those things that sometimes feel a little just like we're politically posturing, actually can become a part of this legal strategy to ensure our comrades' freedom, because they can all be added in additional evidence in that Grumbles motion to appeal to the court and say, this person has made clear from the beginning, they are never going to cooperate, not today, not tomorrow, not ever. And they also have the support from people around to maintain that stance.
Where can people in the listening audience find out more about the currently convened grand jury around Katie Yao and about grand juries in general?
Well, you could follow on Twitter the account NC Resist, and that is, you know, the support crew for Katie Yao down in North Carolina. And you could also check out the website, which is being updated really regularly, ncresistthegrandjury.com. And people are trying to make sure that that's being updated as updates come in.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
Now we have an update from iRadio Berlin.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte,
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell.
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen.
Beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
¡Viva la anarquía!
Estamos convencidos de que a Santiago lo desapareció la gendarmería.
We are convinced that Santiago was taken away by gendarmería.
In this episode of Bad News, we at Anarchist Radio Berlin share some news from outside Germany, coming all the way from Argentina.
On August 1st, Santiago Maldonado, an anarchist in solidarity with Mapuche people in Chubut, Argentina, was taken by gendarmeria agents during a raid and has not been seen since then.
The repressive forces of the state fell on the Pulov community in resistance of Cushamen during a raid in which more than 100 federal agents broke into the reclaimed community, destroying living spaces, shooting rubber bullets, and generally terrorizing people.
This raid is just another of many acts of terror inflicted by the Argentine state on Mapuche people in resistance.
Similarly, brutal raids have taken place in the last months, most notably in January and most recently in June.
Nos empezaron a sacar y a mí me agarraron entre tres.
They started to drag us out. Three cops jumped on me and dragged us over the floor. They got a woman, threw her on the floor. There was another woman who had her child on her, and they pulled her out by the hair and told her, "That's for being an asshole." They beat her up, and they cuffed us up immediately, while the children were still inside, crying.
And it should come as no surprise that Mapuche communities are not only resisting and reclaiming their land from the state, but also from the hands of capitalists. This land in Cushamen happens to be of quite some importance to Luciano Benetton.
Like the clothing brand?
That's right, like the clothing brand. A Benetton subsidiary company owns land in the region roughly the size of Cyprus, and the Cushamen community happens to be in it.
Never mind that Mapuche have lived in this region for more than 1,400 years, predating any attempt at an Argentine state. Unlike what some Benetton spokesperson would have us believe.
Patagonia was land that was not occupied, and the state and the military went in at that time. Later it became property of three Argentine families, and later on Benetton acquired the land from these three families.
The people of the Cushamen community have been in this reclaimed land since March of 2015. And of course, the state claims that the Mapuche are the terrorists.
And of course that the state cares about us, as Patricia Bullrich, the Minister for National Security, likes to tell us.
Feliz día te desea tu ministerio amigo.
We wish you a happy day from your friendly ministry.
Santiago is still missing. Community members and organizations, along with his family, have filed a lawsuit against the Gendarmeria.
In the last days, solidarity demonstrations have taken place throughout different cities of Argentina and also abroad.
Let us not be intimidated. Santiago must come back alive. We must stand in solidarity and resistance with the Mapuche against the state and capital.
We are going to continue fighting. We will reclaim the whole Puel Mapu and the Ngulu Mapu. We are going to take out all of these landowners who came here to remove our grandparents. And now our grandparents don't have water. And we will reclaim all the land. They will have to take us out dead from this land.
If you would like to listen to more audios and news from A Radio Berlin, you can visit our website, aradio.blogsport.de.
And check us out on Twitter at @aradio_Berlin. Have fun.
And finally, it's over to Dissident Ireland.
So the Alliance for Choice campaign for abortion rights in Northern Ireland and to repeal the Eighth in the South?
Yeah, that's right. So we're primarily a campaigning organisation and our jurisdiction is the North of Ireland, where originally we were set up to extend the 1967 Abortion Act of the rest of the United Kingdom, but increasingly we have found that that's not fit for purpose either. So we campaign primarily for free, safe, legal abortions, no matter what the reason. So we do work closely with our sister organisation in the South of Ireland, which is the Abortion Rights Campaign, and they are campaigning for repealing the Eighth. But absolutely, it's a cross-border campaign where we want abortion rights for everybody across the island of Ireland.
About the law, I was reading in that it puts women's health on a par with the fetus. So, like, that kind of sets up conflict, puts it in a position where there's going to be a point where you have to choose between the life of the fetus and the life of the woman.
Yep, absolutely. So the Eighth Amendment in the Republic of Ireland equates the woman or pregnant person's life to be equal to that of the embryo. And similarly, in the Offences Against the Person Act of 1861, which is the abortion law currently in place in the north of Ireland, they deem that the embryo is also a person, which is why it's under criminal law jurisdiction, and which is why women and pregnant people are facing criminal sentences whenever they have abortions. But certainly culturally and from a young age and socially and in education, you're taught from day one that they are equal and have an equal stake in the future, which is where the struggle comes from, and which is why Alliance for Choice doesn't expect that everybody coming into our room will agree with us that the embryo and fetus has the same rights as the person carrying that. So yeah, it's definitely a struggle in terms of culturally shifting the narrative away from the embryo to the choice of the person who will or will not have that eventual child if it's born.
The terminology as well is that the woman's life has to be in danger before, certainly in the South with the Eighth Amendment, that life has to be imminently in danger before any procedure can be taken.
Yeah, and because the law is so vague around that and how we define danger, be that, you know, mental or physical danger, it's so unclear, and also doctors and there's either woefully unprepared for the eventuality that they might actually have to go through with a procedure. I think 16 abortions in total across Island of Ireland were carried out last year. They were all under 9 weeks, and the reality is that hundreds more people every month are having to either go through pregnancies that are going to endanger them or that are inevitably going to end up as miscarriages anyway because the fetus isn't viable. So yeah, the terminology around danger is not properly legislated, and that's why we see very few abortions happening, even in the case that if it is endangering, and we see lots of very vulnerable people having to travel to England and further afield in order to get the medical attention that they desperately need because of this tenuous association with danger. And we obviously have seen deaths in Ireland, most notably a couple of years ago with Savita Halepavanar, but it shouldn't tick for, you know, these women and the woman before her who have died whenever they haven't received the medical attention that they need. So not only that, but being told by doctors that actually you're not in danger enough to then face criminal charges and the social and a professional or political isolation that you will inevitably endure if you then make a decision that you need to take control of your body. So yeah, there's lots of ambiguities around what danger actually means.
So I'm on the line here with Barbara, who is a local campaigner, part of the Frack Free Lancashire campaign. How's it going, Barbara?
It's going very, very well. Getting lots of new people coming down to the site. It's quite encouraging, quite inspiring. All sorts of actions going on. In fact, to be honest, every day is different. There's a different action every day. Some we know about, some I don't know about. They just happen.
So at the moment, we're basically three quarters of the way through a month of rolling resistance, which has been organised in coordination with Reclaim the Power. Before we talk about what's been happening in the last month, I wanted to just take a little step back and look at the history of this campaign in the local community and how it's come about. Because as I understand it, there has been resistance on the site since 2014. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, 2014 was when they announced their plans. You know, in 2011, they tried to frack at a site which was under the radar at a place called Priest Hall, where there were two earthquakes. And then basically, you know, it was all put on hold until February 2014, when Quadrilla announced they wanted to drill and frack up to four exploratory wells at two locations. One's Preston New Road, and the other one is a place called Rosica Wood. So that's when we heard about it, when Quadrilla, you know, said they were going to go ahead, and they put the planning applications in that June of 2014. So yeah, the local people basically started to take note and formed groups. There were already some groups in place before then, but the focus basically came very much on Rosica and on the Preston New Road, and all of the local groups came together under the umbrella of Frack Free Lancashire in June of 2014. And there's been all sorts of actions going on since then, culminating in the Reclaim the Power actions, you know, this last month. But it's gone from being what I would call very much down the line, you know, going through the planning process and lobbying MPs and doing all of the democratic process and, you know, what we thought was the right thing. And now, because the Secretary of State has was overruled. You know, there's a lot of angry local people in Lancashire who don't want this to go ahead and now are determined to do some sort of direct action to try and stop it.
And from your perspective, I mean, what is driving local people to the campaign? Is it that democratic deficit that's opened up? Is it more to do with property prices in the area, to do with preserving the environment? What is driving people?
It's all of those things, to be honest with you. There are people here who obviously have got the very much what I'd call the NIMBY hats on with the, you know, it's our property's going to be affected, you know, it's directly going to affect the capital assets and what have you. There are many, many more people concerned about the impacts of fracking on the environment and on people's health, because obviously they've seen the evidence from abroad and, you know, they've heard the stories and things. You know, locally, people around here are concerned about the 24/7 drilling and thousands of vehicle movements in what is essentially a very rural area. You know, this is not the industrial north, it's not the desolate north, this is a beautiful rural countryside which is known for farming and for rural tourism, etc. So there's a lot of people upset by that, that the impact, you know, hundreds of these sites could have in Lancashire. And then there's the people who are very annoyed about the fact, you know, we've gone through a process, you know, we're supposed to have a say in our own futures. Lancashire County Council deliberated for a long while over the proposals and determined that it wasn't appropriate here, and they didn't want it here. And then people are angry that central government have overruled it. And Sajid Javid, the Secretary of State for Local Communities, knows nothing about the community here. So, you know, lots of people are concerned about that and are angry at lack of democracy involved. So there's people involved in the campaign for numerous reasons. I think the most significant is the fact that people think that fracking is a backward step. Fossil fuel, people know we should be looking forward, we should be looking at renewables, etc., and we should have better policies really on energy.
Thanks for listening. See you all next time for some more bad news.